to talk about today is some ideas that Lucy and I have had about how to unify these different kinds of fault-tolerant constructions into one kind of mathematical structure. So let me start by talking about transversal gates. So transversal gates are one of the most popular ways of doing fault-tolerant quantum computing. I can already see I'm going to have a hand problem here. So, what's a transversal gate? So transversal gate, suppose you have your quantum error correcting code is multiple qubits. 3 is not very many, but just to make it easier to draw, let's start with that. Right. And so a transversal gate, the simplest case, is when it's just single qubit gates on each qubit. So why do we want to do this? Well, the reason is that your quantum error correcting code has some ability to correct errors. But suppose you try to do a 2-qubit gate, like a controlled knot. And you know, the controlled knot might be operating perfectly. But before the controlled knot happens, you have an error on one of the qubits, the first qubit in this example. And then the problem is that the error can then spread along the controlled knot gate. And instead of having just one error, you're going to have 2 errors. And the problem with having 2 errors is that your quantum error correcting code has some capability of correcting errors. Suppose your code is capable of correcting just 1 error out of its many qubits. And then, you know, if you had 1 error here, that was fine. But then if you did the C naught, it propagated, even though the C naught was itself perfect. And now you have 2 errors, and the code can't correct it anymore. That's where the transversal gates come in. The transversal gates, in this case, if you have single qubit gates, they can't spread errors that occur. Right? If there's an error here, it stays here. Because the single qubit gates don't interact the different qubits. Now, of course, in the course of the computation, you might want to do some 2-qubit gates. And single qubit gates are not going to be enough. So the way to do that using transversal gates is to have 2 blocks of the code and connect them as such, as the So what you can do is you can, for instance, do a control NOT gate between the first qubit of the first block and the second qubit of the first block. Sorry, the first qubit of the first block with the first qubit of the second block. The second qubit with the second qubit, the third qubit with the third qubit, and so on. And then if errors spread, so for instance, if there's an error here, it'll spread into the second block. But then each block has only 1 error. And that's still something the codes can handle, because this block can correct 1 error, and this block can also correct 1 error. In general, the way I want to define transversal gate, first of all, it should map the code space to the code space. So if the code space is Q, then our transversal gate has the property that U of Q is equal to Q again. And then the second property is that it has this tensor product form. So a U is equal to the tensor product over the qubits of the code of UI.
Four-dimensional Q dip. These two and these two. And then this picture here looks something like this. We have 3 big lines, each of which is now a 4-dimensional Q dip. And each one here has a little 2-qubit C naught gate.
Okay, so this is transversal gates. I guess it was on the whole time. Okay, anyway, so the next thing to talk about is a different kind of gate, which is gates by code deformation.
Sorry, still getting the
hang of turning the mic for the Zoom people. I'm still getting the hang of turning my microphone on and off so you can hear Lucy. Anyway, so gates by code deformation are common in certain kinds of
code, for instance, the surface code. And so the surface code, you might have, you know, big lattice with lots of qubits, and there'll be some defects in it, which are used to encode the logical qubit. And then to do a gate in a surface code, well, there's various different ways that have been proposed. But one way is to move these defects around. So for instance, this one might move up here. And that by itself is not enough to do a gate. In fact, it's a little bit confusing whether it's done a gate or not, because these are kind of formally separate codes, right? There's one code that has this defect here and this defect here. And then there's a different code that has this defect here and this defect here. And it's not immediately clear how to compare them to say, well, you know, the encoded information is this before and it's something else after. Because they're different codes, you don't know how to compare them. And so the solution to that is to keep going, to keep moving this defect all the way around until it gets right back to where you started, and you're back to the original code. And then you can compare this code before the gate to this code after the gate and see if it's changed. And so, what we can do is think of this as moving through a series of different codes, right? We'll have, you know, the starting code, which is at the defects here.
And then the second code has the defects here.
And the third code
might have the defects here.
And then we continue moving and eventually get back to the original code. So if you think about code deformation versus transversal gates, they have some fairly different properties. So, for instance, the transversal gates form a group. If you take the product of two transversal gates, you get another transversal gate. Whereas the gates by code deformation form a group poid. You can take the product of, you know, the ability you can move defects from here to here, and you can move defects from here to here, but you can't do this step starting from this configuration. It doesn't make sense, because this step is saying, well, we're going to move this defect over here, and if there's no defect there, you can't do that. And the other way in which the code deformation is different from the transversal gates is that the transversal gates kind of automatically limited error propagation in the way that we talked about, right? That the error can only propagate in a way that's allowed by the code error correction properties. Whereas in this kind of code deformation, that doesn't happen automatically. If you have an error that's over here, it might kind of get dragged along by moving the defect, and you might have, you know, a string of errors here. And in fact, just the process of moving it, depending on how you do it, that might itself introduce error. And so what you have to do is you have to periodically stop and say, well, I've reached this intermediate stage. I better do error correction. And then over here, I'll do error correction again, and so on. And so you don't need to do that with the Kronzdorfer gate. The error correction is automatic. But for the code deformation, because you have to stop and do error correction along the way, you have to be careful that all of the codes that you're moving through also are pretty good at correcting errors. If they're less good than the original code, then you're going to have a period where you're not well protected against error. Okay, and that's an opportunity for something to go wrong that could ruin your computation. Okay, so these things seem fairly different, but actually what I'm going to argue today is that transversal gates can be viewed as a kind of code deformation. So how do we do that? Well, the first thing to realize is that when you do a transversal gate, you know, you have to do this tensor product of unit trace, but you can't just, you know, snap your fingers and make the unit trace happen. Instead, you know, in the real system, you would have some Hamiltonian that you, okay, this is real for a theorist. You have some Hamiltonian that you turn on, which means like turning on a laser. And so you're creating some interaction, some change in the system, and you're leaving that Hamiltonian on for some time. And during that time, you start out by the original state, but then it changes slowly or quickly, it changes continuously over time until you reach the final UIs that you wanted for this gate. And so what we can do is we can think of that as the path in the unitary group. So we're starting at the identity, and we're ending at U. And in between, we have this path U of T. Okay, so we have U of 0 is equal to the identity. U of big T is equal to U, the gate that we're trying to do. As we do this unitary path, it's going to transform the code space into different things. Suppose instead of getting all the way to the end, we stop somewhere in the middle. Well, the original code space has been rotated, and you have the code space U of T of Q. And so now we're thinking about lots of different subspaces of the Hilbert space. And so this thing forms a path along the set of different subspaces. And it's a path on something called the Grassmannian. So the Grassmannian, okay, so now let me define the Grassmannian. So GR of K, I guess 2 to the n here, is going to be the set of subspaces of dimension K of 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space. And then this thing here, which we can call gamma of T, is a path in the Grassmannian. It starts as this unitary path, so this is induced by the unitary path. Oh, we have talked about doing some different colors. So it starts at Q because the unitary path starts at the identity. And then we get back to Q because the path ends at U, which has this property that it maps Q to Q. Okay, so what we'd like to do now is understand how the encoded states behave under a loop like this in the Grassmannian. So in particular, we're going to have to introduce some more mathematical structure here. And that mathematical structure is going to be a fiber bundle. So what's a fiber bundle? A fiber bundle, so this Grassmannian forms a manifold, actually. And a fiber bundle has, for each point in the manifold, it has an additional space. In this case, it's going to be a vector space, so it's going to be a vector bundle. In this particular vector bundle, well, remember the Grassmannian is a space. Each point represents a subspace of the Hilbert space. And so the vector space that we're going to talk about is just a copy of that particular subspace. So what we'd like to do now is understand how the vectors transform, the vectors in one fiber transform to points in a different fiber when we go along a path in the Grassmannian. And the mathematical structure that does that in a fiber bundle is called the connexin. What's the kind of the natural connection on this fiber bundle? When we move from vectors from here to vectors, say, for the fiber here, what is the natural transformation that we would get by going along this path? Well, it turns out that there isn't one. So that's kind of disappointing. But so why isn't there one? So let's draw this picture again and try to understand it. So remember that the paths here are induced by unitary paths, right? But the problem is that here we are in SU2 to the n, and we can have multiple different paths that will do the same thing in the Grassmannian. So we're going to have here U1 of T, U2 of T, and they both correspond to the same path, let's say same loop, gamma, right? Gamma of T down in the Grassmannian. Okay, so why is that a problem? Well, the problem is that while you can take a vector. So we have, you want it to be acting on some vector where v here is in Q. So these two paths, you want it, sorry, this is what I meant to say. You want a T acting on Q is the same as U2 of T acting on Q at all times. So this is a statement that these two unitary paths cause the same path down here at gamma. But while that's true, it can also be true that U1 of T acting on a specific vector, V, in the fiber, is not equal to U2 of 2 acting on the different vector, on the vector V in the fiber, right? It can be some additional rotation. The subspace as a whole maps to the same place, but it may get rotated in different ways along these three unitary paths. Okay, and so what that means is that parallel transport along gamma is not well defined. There's multiple possible ways to parallel transport vectors along gamma that correspond to these different unitary paths. Okay, so what are we going to do about this? You know, this picture that I've been developing is not making sense. But remember, this part here, this is true for general unitaries. And we have our particular focus right now is on transversal gates, which are special. And so we should use some of the properties of transversal gates, or the definition of transversal gates, to hopefully do better. Okay, so the transversal gates, since they all have this tensor product form, will map our original code space into not an arbitrary code space, because there's only certain subspaces that you can get to by doing something of this form. So what we have instead is the orbit of SU2 tensor N acting on the space Q. And this thing is a proper subset of the Grothmann. Question. Yeah. So I mean, obviously, it's not true for general paths. So what I want to do is I want to focus attention on two particular paths that have this property, because there are such paths, and point out that even when this is true, this doesn't have to be true, and that's why parallel transport is not well defined in general. I forget which one this is. Do you remember this? What's the name of this bundle? Is this the tautological bundle or?
I forgot the name also.
There are a couple of different bundles. In the paper we talk about is also a different one where the fiber is the frame, you know, but this one may be the tautological one, but I don't remember exactly.
I guess for the case, yeah, it could be mentioned, for the case where the fibers are in quantum mechanics, as space is defined only up to the overall free factor, what rules? You care about the overall free factor?
So if you want to be like super careful about this, you should work with projective Hilbert spaces, and that gets rid of that global phase factor. And I've kind of You know, sort of been doing that already because I have this S here. That's what that's for, to get rid of that global trace factor. It doesn't really affect any of the things that I'm talking about right now. This property, you know, you can certainly get examples where there's a global phase difference, and then you can say, that's not what I'm interested in. But there are cases where it's not just a global phase difference. It's easy to come up with examples actually like that. Well, it's easy to come up with examples where that happens. Obviously, if you just take kind of two random paths, they're going to be different paths in the Grassmannian. But, you know, if you just take any path you want, and then you say, on top of that, I'm going to add some rotation on the subspace Ju. You know, I'm going to the instantaneous subspace, you know, gamma of t. If I have every time I'm moving along gamma of t, I'm also doing a little bit of a rotation within the subspace and leaving the subspace otherwise, you know, the not changing with subspace gap. You can just write it down, and it's easy to come up with examples like that for general unitary. That's right. So I want to look at an example where we have two unitary paths that map down to the same gamma of t.
So this is show that there's no connection defined on it. So it's like a little bit for mathematical purposes. So you can't define this thing, so there's no natural connection in the general case.
The point is that let me back up a little bit. So I introduce this by saying we want to find the connection. Okay. So the connection could say, well, given a path gamma of t and q, that tells us what happens to the fiber, how the fiber gets rotated. This is giving a counterexample to that, saying, well, you can't do that, right? If you said, well, I'm going to do it, in order to rotate, I'm going to pick some unitary path U1 of t, and I'd say, well, what about U2 of t? That's just as good. Why didn't you pick that one? Okay, but in the case of transversal gates, we can't just pick arbitrary U1 and U2. We have to pick gates of this form, okay? And that's very restricting, and that means that instead of exploring the whole Grassmannian, we're only exploring this submanifold of the Grassmannian, what the transversal gates, the local unitaries, act on the original code subspace. Okay, so what happens when we're restricting attention to this code subspace? Suppose we have U1 of t and U2 of t that have this property, that they both give the same path down here, and that's still possible that can happen. But they're both of this form. They're both transversal gates. So now I want to consider a slightly different path where we don't go through this whole thing here. Instead, we're going to start out, we're going to go a little ways up here, and then we're going to stop, and then we're going to go back this way. So in particular, we're going to do this path that starts with the identity, and then it goes to U1 of epsilon, and then it switches over to U2 of epsilon, and then it goes back to the identity. And the reason we can do this is because, you know, what happens down here in the Grassmannian, the base space of the vector bundle? Well, we start out at Q, and at this point we get mapped to gamma of epsilon. And because U1 of epsilon acts on Q to give U1 and U2 do the same thing. Sorry, that's not a good place to write, I see.
Okay. So this is the path we want to do, the unitary path. And here we started with Q, and we map to gamma of epsilon. And since U1 of t is equal, acting on Q is equal to U2 of t acting on Q for all t, this is the same thing that we get whether we use U1 or U2. And then we're going to go back to Q. And so this path here doesn't necessarily get us the fiber back to where it started. That was kind of our concern before. But let's figure out what unitary does do. Well, it does U1 of epsilon. And then how do you go on a path from U2 of epsilon to U1? Well, you do U2 inverse of epsilon. And both U1 of epsilon and U2 of epsilon are transversal gates because we're only restricting the connection to paths that are transversal. And so the product here is also a transversal gate. And moreover, when epsilon is small, it's going to be a small transversal gate, right? So it's mapping Q back to Q. So it's satisfying our definition of transversality. And when epsilon is small, well, we haven't done very much. So it's necessarily going to be something very small. But those of you who are familiar with the theory of fault-tolerant quantum computation will know of the Easton-Nil theorem. And the Easton-Nil theorem says that the group of transversal gates for any quantum code is a discrete group. And so in particular, there are no small logical gates. So if it's a small logical gate, the only thing it can be is the identity, the logical identity. Now it can do something that's non-identity outside the code space, but acting just on the code space, it maps the fibers back to themselves in exactly the same way. The vectors get back to exactly where they started. So in this case, that means that we don't have this anymore. Instead, we have U2 of epsilon inverse U1 of epsilon acting on vector V is supposed to give us the identity acting on V. It gives us V again. And that in turn tells us that U1 of epsilon acting on V is equal to U2 of epsilon acting on V. And that means that parallel transport is well defined along these curves because both U1 and U2 give the same result. Okay, so that's good. So that means that the connection here is a well-defined quantity. And when we restrict attention to this submanifold of the Riemannian, we do have a natural connection. And so if you think about this argument here, it didn't really depend on these paths being all the same. Only the endpoint had to be the same. We used that property, but the endpoint was the same. But between here and here, it didn't matter whether that was the same as going here to here. So But now let's look at a slightly different fixture here, where we have gamma 1 of t up here and gamma 2 of t down here that are taking this q into the same point, but they're going in different ways. So, provided both of them are very small, this argument applies again exactly in the same way. And we know that they have to do the same thing to the vectors in the fibrobar. Now, if they're bigger, you can still get the same result by kind of breaking it up into lots of little circles. There's a more careful argument in our paper. But the upshot is that even when these things are far away, provided you can continuously deform these paths into each other, they'll give the same parallel transport result. And what that means is that not only is the connection well-defined on the submanifold, but it doesn't depend on the details of the path. And that means that the connection is actually a flat connection. Okay, and so that tells us something kind of profound about the nature of the fault tolerance, which is that if you have a loop, remember the original focus is on loop for transversal gate, and if the loop goes back to the start and it's a topologically trivial path that can be deformed to the identity, then it must do the logical identity operation. Whereas if you have a transversal gate that does a non-trivial logical operator, you know it has to be something that's not deformable to the identity. That's a topologically non-trivial loop in the Grassmannian. So that's kind of our conclusion, that, you know, even though these transversal gates look very different from co-deformation gates, we can still think of them as a kind of co-deformation. And moreover, not just co-deformation, but the process of doing a transversal gate is a topological effect in the Grassmannian. So actually, then you can say, well, what about the original co-deformation gates, like in the surface code? Now, people normally do those by doing like a sequence of measurements that cause the defects to move around. But you can kind of replace that by some local unitaries that cause the defects to move in much the same way. The details of that are a bit complicated. It's in our paper. Then the section of the subset of the Grassmannian that you're dealing with is not this submanifold. It's instead something that's isomorphic to the configuration space of the defects, basically. And then you're moving around in that subset of the Grassmannian in much the same way as you did in this case.
That's right.
So I guess I skipped that. So it depends on one spectral property of Q, which is that it has a minimum distance, which is this coding theory property, of at least two. But the code, this subspace Q, has to be able to detect single qubit errors. And that's all. It's a very minimal error correction property, but if you take an arbitrary subspace, it's not true. Some subspaces don't have that property.
Just about this, what's the intuition of why it has to be?
Yeah. So,
So the intuition is that any kind of small perturbation is going to look like an error to your error correcting code. And so if you have any kind of small perturbation of transversal gate, so that's like you're doing something separate. Here, I can, let me write. So So a small transversal gate is going to look something like this. This, again, is intuition. The details involve Lie algebras, but this is captures a lot of the idea. So if you have something like this, right, it can be expanded as, let's look at the first order term, that's the identity here, and then we have epsilon U1 plus U2 plus U3 plus dot, dot, dot. And our code is capable of kind of identifying these single qubit errors. And because of the linearity of quantum mechanics, if it can identify, you know, U1, U2, U3 separately, it can identify the sum of them as well. And so this part here looks like an error to the code. That means that it kind of has to be zero, or the code, or this wouldn't be mapping the code space to the code space. So that means that this kind of ends up as the logical identity, and that the things that are interesting and happen have to be happening at second order, which in the limit as epsilon goes to zero is negligible. Okay, any other questions?
So this assumes that like our
unitaries
at every concept, like,
is this
like usually reasonable?
Right. So no, our unitaries are not going to keep us in the code space at every concept. In fact, they can't, also by the Nielsen-Mill theorem. But at every time step, so the paths are transversal paths, right? So what we're doing is we're transforming the original code by a tensor product unitary. That means that at every time, I mean, actually everywhere in the submanifold, we have codes who have the same distance and the same basic error correction properties as our original code do. So for the Eastern-Hill still applies for all of those codes. No. So I think your question, I repeat partly to the audience, probably for my own benefit. You're asking if all code deformations can be viewed as transversal gates? So our claim is the other way around, that all transversal gates can be viewed as code deformations. But they're definitely code deformations that do not have, you know, this tensor product structure, that we're going through paths that involve other kinds of unitaries, and therefore those are not transversal gates.
So then, for example, if I have
Sorry, say again. So the code switching interpretation there is that, you know, halfway through doing the Hadamard gate, you're in some other code, which is not, I mean, it's isomorphic to a color code, but it formally is a different code, right?
So you switch to that code, and then you're switching back to the color code. And the process of doing those two things together gives you the Hadamard gate. I think it's mostly the Eastern Null theorem that no longer applies here. And I mean, if you have an approximate code that happens to have this property, that the set of transversal gates is a discrete set, then this argument could apply. I mean, the fact that it's approximate or not approximate is kind of also a property of the error model and the error correction procedure, which is not really relevant to this argument. This argument is only about the algebraic structure of the code space. Anyway, so the fact that we're able to unify these two seemingly very different classes of fault-tolerant gates suggests to us, Lucy and I, that this could be actually a much more general thing, because there's an underlying intuition here, which is that, you know, if you want to do a fault-tolerant gate, well, you can often view this in this way as a path, a code deformation path, right? A path in the Grassmannian. And then the fact that it's a fault-tolerant gate, a fault-tolerant implementation, means that this path, or at least the action on the fiber, the holonomy, could be robust against small changes in the path, small errors in the implementation. And that therefore, you know, the holonomy shouldn't depend on the details of the path, and in fact should only depend on the topological properties of the path. And so then our intuition, therefore, is that fault-tolerant gates in general can be viewed as a topological effect in this picture that we've presented. But we also think that it could go the other way, that, you know, if you have some subset of the Grassmannian that has the property that it has a flat connection under the kind of the unitary paths, that natural unitary paths that give you that subset, then that means that gates that you perform that way are robust against small changes in the path, and therefore they should be relatively fault tolerant against certain kinds of errors. And so our conjecture then is that, in some sense, which has not yet been completely defined, that all fault-tolerant gate constructions can be understood as topological effects using a picture like this, and vice versa. Okay, thanks. Are there more questions? Yeah.
I think I understand why the this fiber bond with the book is magnified. What's the motivation to choose the fiber to also be?
No, the fiber is not the Grassmannian. The fiber is the subspace, the Hilbert subspace, at the specific point in the Grassmannian. So the motivation is, first of all, it's kind of a natural thing to think of, since the points are subspaces and we want to have a vector space as a fiber. But secondly, the action on that particular vector space is the thing that we're really interested in. That's the thing that tells us the logical gate that's being performed. Any other questions? Yeah.
I'm just wondering, you came up with the idea for this style of
Right. I'm gonna pass that one off to Lucy. Can I give you a microphone maybe?
Yeah, so I think I always had the idea of how you turn science into music, when you make some composition or semi-improvised, semi-composed music. Based on science, especially ones that I deeply understand, but that's a longer term project. And then at some point we were at KITT, this is when there was this master program that I was involved in, and I met Pam Kibbleson. And she's an artist, and she's an artist in residence at Stanford. So she invited me to do a performance at Stanford, based on some of these ideas and, how this doing science into music for the idea and improvised through screens of sometimes the animated animation of the gravity waves or some sort of visual waves, something that I'm not as an expert in, but I kind of got the gist of it and tried to depict that. So that was my practice run, yes. So we did three performances within 4 days or something like that. So that was fun. And I haven't done much really since then, but I think, and I was thinking the correctly, so it's something that I kind of, I'm interested in doing, and it's just a matter of, I was actually just with Benny that, so this seems like a good opportunity, since we have both kind of was thinking about giving talks, and kind of in one time slot, so, and I also thought about, going on, so maybe that's enough. You can ask me more after. But it's fun. I don't know. I will be happy to hear any feedback from you guys later. What you like about it, what you don't like about it, what works, what do you think? How do you think it matches up with science? Any comments are welcome or not?
Yeah, so we'll be here for the rest of the week. Not performing, but around.